Regarding meditation, those instructions were short. And you can spend a lifetime, as those of you who have been doing it for a long time know, you can spend a lifetime exploring meditation practice. So what you've heard this morning, for those of you who are new to meditation, that's a beginning, but it's not the whole story. However, that is the ultimate teaching. So in a sense, it is the whole story. But know that meditation is something that unfolds and evolves and opens as we go and as we practice. So there's plenty of opportunity for that as you go on with meditation in your lives. The other thing that I want to say is that Buddhism is fundamentally about wholeness, about our already wholeness. And Dogen, who is credited with founding Soto Zen, the Soto Zen tradition in Japan, and the monks from Shasta Abbey, our tradition is in the Soto Zen tradition. He is famous for saying, when the opposites arise, the Buddha mind is lost. And this is one of my favorite things that he has said. And part of what he's pointing to is when we start to think about good and bad, or right or wrong, or male or female, we're already wrong. That we've lost the Buddha mind, which holds everything within its awareness. And I think that when we have a day like today, where we've sort of pulled out a particular characteristic of being human, namely femaleness, it's important to keep this in mind, that if we begin to exclude, or if we begin to bump up against, you know, be combative, we're in a sense making a mistake, because the Buddha mind doesn't exclude anything. So while today we are focusing on the female, we do that within the context of this wholeness. And in that light, I would actually like to acknowledge the courage of the men who are here. I was thinking last night, would I have the courage to walk into a room full of men to join a retreat on the male in Buddha in Buddhism? So I want to acknowledge you for coming and participating in this. And as we tried to say in our in the poster that we created for this day, we all participate in both genders to one degree or another. Nobody's completely male, nobody's completely female. And frankly, I'm not sure what those things are anyway. So we have this opportunity today to explore our femaleness, and both men and women can participate in that exploration. So I would like that to be the ground and foundation for everything that we do today, the spirit of what we do today. Okay, so I want to go back to that scripture we recited, the scripture of great wisdom, because we recited that scripture for very, with intention. There's a reason for that scripture being in that place now. To step back one step, this morning we're going to be focusing on two female Buddhas, or female archetypes that occur in Buddhism, and most of our conversation will be about them. And we will have time for, this morning I'm going to be doing most of the talking, but there will be time today for conversation, discussion, questions, and all of that sort of thing. So bear with us, we will get to that, and it's important that we all talk together. And the first female Buddha I want to talk about is Prajnaparamita, who is this woman on the altar here. And I don't know if you'll remember, but in the scripture it says, the Prajnaparamita one should know to be the greatest mantra of them all. And that's referring to Prajnaparamita as a mantra, but that comes from this woman. who is known as the mother of all the Buddhas. Now let me take one step back and say that the scripture of great wisdom, which we recite every morning in the monastery as a part of our training, is also known as the Heart Sutra, and more commonly known as the Heart Sutra. So some of you may have come across it under that guise. This particular translation was done by our founder, Reverend Master G.U. Kennett, a British woman who we'll say more about later, and other Buddhist traditions who recite this scripture will have different translations of it, but those of you who are familiar with it in other translations might have noticed the resemblance. This sutra is called the Heart Sutra, not just because it has to do with the heart. And the first line says, when one with deepest wisdom of the heart, but also because it's the core teaching of our tradition. And having said that, I could understand how somebody would read this for the first time and it would sound like gibberish and you wouldn't have any idea what this is about. What the scripture is about is what Prajnaparamita is about. And so I want to talk about her and about the great wisdom, which is Prajnaparamita, so we have some idea of what this female Buddha has to teach us. And I'll say, you know, I began by saying that she's the mother of all the Buddhas. And I want to say that when I registered this, and I was a monk for quite a number of years before I registered this, I was really astonished because, in a sense, she's prior to all the Buddhas, and she is that out of which all the Buddhas come. And I hope as we talk it will become clear how that is so. But she's not well known. We don't notice her much. And it was startling to me that within, you know, we're so familiar with the male Buddha, historical Buddha, on the altar sitting in meditation, which is, I think, a really important image for us. We don't notice that behind all that is a woman, and that who she is can be inspiring to us all. And my hope is that by talking about her and about Avalokiteshvara, who we'll talk about later in the morning, that they will offer inspiration to both men and women training, and particularly offer us the possibility of seeing the greatness, if you will, of our own femaleness and what that offers to the world. So Prajnaparamita is a long name, and Prajna is a commonly used word in Buddhism which means wisdom. I learned recently that the etymology of the word is, it means before knowledge. So, isn't that interesting? Prajna is the wisdom that comes before knowledge. And paramita literally means crossing over to the other shore, which in Buddhism is an image for reaching enlightenment, reaching nirvana, for transcendence of the world of suffering, which we call samsara, the everyday mundane world of suffering. So Prajnaparamita is the before knowledge wisdom of crossing to the other shore. Yeah, it's one of six paramitas that include things like generosity and patience and precepts that we train in as a part of our daily training as Buddhists. So it's one of those six virtues, but it's also this woman who is sitting on the altar. It is hard to find images of her, by the way. We tried to fill the room with images of female Buddhas. The Tibetan tradition is the tradition that's most full of images of female Buddhas, and there is a book on the table over here of Tibetan art that's all female Buddhas. So that can be interesting to look at to fill out our collection here. So I started to say that images of her are somewhat rare, but potent, I think. And let's see, I wanted to draw your attention to one in particular. It's very small, you can look at it later, but you see that collection of five sort of postcards over there? The very bottom one is Prajnaparamita. It's a Cambodian image, and I have a look at her face. It's very stark and austere, but strong and still, impressively still, with strength in that stillness. So it's very different from this image of her. So have a look at that later. Okay, so what I want to talk about is this wisdom that she's the embodiment of. And that wisdom in Buddhism is called shunyata. Shunyata is a word that is usually translated as emptiness. Now, it can mean openness, inconceivability, unlimitedness, but it's usually translated as emptiness. And in this rendition of the Scripture of Great Wisdom, Reverend Master translates it as void, unstained, and pure. And she used that word pure because she wanted to point to something positive. And emptiness can often connote something negative to us, something pessimistic. But in fact, this form of emptiness is not a kind of nihilistic empty emptiness. What it points to on the one hand is our interconnectedness and our interdependence. Shunyata, or emptiness, is emptiness of a separate self. It's pointing to the lack of existence of a separate self. Now, it's really easy to, it's very deeply ingrained in us that we are each separate from each other. It's quite clear that I'm in this body bounded by this skin, and you're in a different body bounded by your skin. And you know, we can pick you up over there and pick me up over here, and we're not. You know, we're two different things. We don't have each other's thoughts. We don't have each other's memories. You know, the whole shebang. But what emptiness is trying to point to is that that sense of our separateness is actually a delusion. And in fact, the sense of our separateness is to me, the fundamental delusion. It's the, what we would say in Zen, it's the fundamental koan. It's the spiritual question that everybody is attempting to resolve in some way or another. You might not word it that way, but it's the fundamental question that we are looking for an answer to in our religious life and spiritual training. And the teaching of emptiness, or shunyata, is that in fact we're not disconnected or separate from each other. And one way of explaining that is to take this piece of paper and consider what it's made of. It's, and some of you may have heard this, is actually a somewhat famous way of talking about emptiness from Thich Nhat Hanh. Yeah, and it's really good. So you've got a piece of paper, and this piece of paper is made from the pulp of a tree. So in this piece of paper is a tree. The tree, and Lord knows what else it's made from, you know, the tree is possible because of the soil, the water, the sun, the rain, the nutrients in the soil, the organisms in the soil, the microorganisms in the soil. And really, you know, you can connect that tree to all the animals in the forest, even, you know, the higher animals, and the way the whole ecosystem interacts with itself. And then you've got the lumberjack who felled the tree, and the lumberjack's parents, who gave birth to the lumberjack and raised the lumberjack. And you have the lumberjack's breakfast, which fed the lumberjack so that the tree could be felled. And where did all that food come from? And the farmers who planted the food, those who harvested it, the trucks that carried it to market, the gasoline that fueled the truck, I think you get the picture. This chain is never ending, and it links everything. And it's not just one chain. You know, there are strands off each link, you know, so that what, in effect, every single thing is connected to every single other thing. Everything that we think of as a thing is connected to every single other thing. So, in this piece of paper is the whole universe. And this brings us back to how, you know, what I said at the beginning about Buddhism being about wholeness. So this word emptiness is actually pointing to this fullness, to the fact that this piece of paper contains everything that exists, and to the fact that we are all actually interconnected, codependent, if you will. Interdependent, interrelated, interbeing is Thich Nhat Hanh's word. It's a beautiful way of putting it, actually, for those of you who are Thich Nhat Hanh aficionados. So this emptiness is pointing to this lack of a separate self, but that lack of a separate self points us directly into our interconnectedness. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's we're lacking a substantial self nature. What this is trying to point to is that any concept we have of something is at some level wrong. Now, it's very useful and helpful. It's very useful for me to know that, you know, I'm who I am, and for you to know who you are too. Anytime we have the sense of a thing, you know, a book, or a chair, or a person, or an idea, or an opinion, or a belief, or a memory, or an emotion, you know, anger or joy. Anytime we give a word to something, in effect, and again, none of this is wrong, it's very useful, it helps us to survive, but anytime we do that, there's a sense in which we're making a mistake, because we're not seeing everything else that it is. We're not seeing that web of interconnection, which actually links every single thing to every other thing. You know, I keep imagining these little spider web strands that connect us all in some way. And there's communication across those strands. You know, we're actually hearing each other, even though it may not seem like it. And even though, you know, some of us can, I can't read each other's thoughts, you know. So what is happening with emptiness is that every time we, and this is what Prajnaparamita is all about, every time we set up a thingness, it undermines it. It says, no, actually that thing doesn't exist. You know, you're seeing it in a kind of diluted way. Now, that doesn't mean that's bad, don't do it. It just means there's more to it than that. And so when we live from the perspective of emptiness, it's as if every time you take a step forward, the ground falls away from you. And somehow you take the next step and the ground falls away again. And you take another step and the ground falls away again. And I don't, you know, that doesn't make any sense logically, but it's like, it's as if we're living in free fall. And that works because there's no ground to hit. Because every time we set something up as true, it falls away. Every time we think we've got it, it falls away. Every time we have a construct that we think, now I can hold on to this, I've got it, I know how to live, I know how to train, I know how to be a good person, whatever it is, it gets undermined in some way. It drops away from us. So this extends even to enlightenment, nirvana, and Buddhahood. So even, this is the meaning actually of that saying, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him, or her. it's saying, you know, that if you have conceptualized the Buddha, if you know what it is, you're wrong about it. And yes, those conceptualizations conceptualizations can be useful, and yes, they can draw us in the right direction, but we're actually wrong about it at some level. And it's remembering that we're also wrong that's really helpful, because every time we grab mine, I'm going to keep this, we're creating suffering. And this is one of the Buddha's first teachings, is that this is how we create suffering. We create suffering by trying to hold on to things, through attachment, desire, aversion. We try to hold on to things, or we try to get rid of things. I'm not going to throw this. And so we, by this holding on, we create attachment. By recognizing that this thing isn't actually mine and it isn't what I'm conceiving it of, we allow space to open up. So another aspect of emptiness is actually this sense of spaciousness, this open space in which we can see things as they are. And things, instead of being objects that are hard and fast that we can hold on to, or Buddhas being objects that are hard and fast that we can hold on to, or our training or our deep spiritual insight being something hard and fast that we can hold on to. In fact, there are no things. There is just the shifting, changing, flowing fluidity of life, always moving, always changing. So what is trying to be said through this teaching is that there isn't a thing to which change happens. You know, I've got the book and I bend it or write in it or and it changes, or the paper disintegrates and it changes. There's not something to which change is happening. There is simply this change. There is simply the flowing, moving, changing of life. Like a flowing river. Does that make sense? So that's what, I'm sorry, because I started to talk about space and then I got into that sense of change. But another aspect of emptiness is that things actually are empty, that it is about vast open space. One of my favorite statistics is that if you take all the space out of the planet Earth, you would have something the size of a basketball. That's what would be left. There's so much space in an atom or a molecule, and between molecules, if you took all the space out, the Earth would be this big. And so we actually are incredibly spacious, and we can feel very solid, but we're incredibly spacious, and that spaciousness can give us a sense of unbounded, unlimited, because we're not a concept. We're actually open, moving, changing, and flowing. So there can be this sense of openness and possibility. We're not stuck. And it's because of emptiness, actually, because we're capable of changing, that we all can become Buddha. If we were just things, we'd be stuck where we are. But in fact, we're not stuck where we are. And we all know that from our personal experience. We all can grow and develop and walk the path towards Buddhahood. So I think of emptiness in that form as being something like... I want to try to give a couple of examples that might give you a sense of how emptiness might feel like. And, you know, one of them is just... as you sit in meditation and you allow things to be as they are, there's an opening up that happens. And sometimes some people experience that actually as space, their bodies being very spacious, or space within their bodies. Things become less substantial, less solid, less frozen. But I once was, we have at the Abbey, we have a great big boiler, wood-fired boiler for our kitchen. Heats the hot water. And it's fed with wood, and one day I was loading it up. There was a really hot fire in this boiler, and I threw a log in, and I didn't see that on the log there was a moth. And it went, so this log, it's a terrible story, this log went into this really hot fire, and I saw the moth when it flew off the log. Well, the instant it flew off the log, it burst into flames and disappeared. And that happened so fast. Come on in. Come on in. Good to see you. I think we need three more chairs. Have we got them?
We got them.
We got them. Okay. Oh, yeah. You can put your shoes out there and come on in. So this moth... this moth instantly disappeared. And to me, there was this... Hi, Tim. Come on in. So we have Ella, yes, and Christine, and Tim. Good to see you all. Do you have chairs? Here we come. So this moth burned up in a flash, and you know, it's something in me just changed. I don't know how to convey this, but it was, whoa. And to me, that was kind of a physical representation of emptiness, if I can put it that way. Another example might be the Buddhist, some of you will be aware of Tibetan Buddhist monks who create very complicated and intricate sand mandalas, and they work very carefully for days with this sand, colored sand, creating a very complex mandala picture of their view of the universe with all these beings in it and houses in it. And when it's all done, they do this to it. They wipe it out. I mean, they just wipe it out. We don't want to wipe out
River. No, it's all right. She's empty.
You're empty. We can wipe you out. Yeah. Now, don't go that way. So this phenomenal creation that we would want to, you know, lacquer and keep forever in our museums is just swept away. And that sweeping away, that returning of this sand to the Dharmakaya, in effect, to the universe, to the atmosphere, is a way of illustrating emptiness. Now, I do want to say that... I think that all of us experience this in some way. And I think part of the reason that Prajnaparamita is hidden from us as much as she is, and part of the reason that emptiness can and shunyata can seem like a kind of obscure Buddhist concept that we don't really understand, and I think that's partly because we think it's some big, great thing that we don't have any access to. We're just ordinary, you know, people doing our best. But I think that, in fact, when we, when you look at the stars, you know, and you recognize the awesome vastness of the universe, just the miraculousness of things, that our bodies work at all is incredible, you know. music. The way that music can transport us out of ourselves, these experiences that we have in which self is dissolved, lovemaking, you know, or love for another person, that kind of thing, again, as I said, transports us out of ourselves, and we can actually have a sense in those moments of what emptiness is pointing towards. The most direct way to practice and experience emptiness is meditation practice. When we sit in meditation and we don't hold on to what's arising, we don't try to make it stay, and we don't push it away or try to get rid of it, we're sitting in this very still point, not moving, not doing anything, not doing anything to what's happening. That still point is the experience of shunyata, or emptiness, or prajnaparamita. Now, I want to say a little bit about her, because, and this book, by the way, is the scripture of great wisdom in 8,000 lines. This Heart Sutra comes from a whole body of Buddhist sutras that were written about the time of Christ in the subsequent centuries. One of them is in 100,000 lines. The Heart Sutra is the core teaching of these sutras, and that's what this book is. But I wanted to say a little bit about Prajnaparamita, who I said is known as the mother of the Buddhas. And she's known as the mother of the Buddhas because it's impossible to enter enlightenment without having insight into the wisdom that she embodies, namely shunyata, or emptiness. And that's why I've spent as much time as I have talking about emptiness. Because this is the wisdom that she has embodied in a female, and all Buddhas who exist are born out of this wisdom, and it's crucial that they enter into that wisdom in order to become Buddha. And I guess what I want to say here is that the historical Buddha is the Buddha that we know of who lived in our time. But in fact, Buddhas are countless. And I could go even further and say that all of us are Buddhas, but we'll leave that discussion for another time. So this scripture says, this is in this sutra that was written, you know, at the time of Christ, Prajnaparamita, mother of the Buddhas, is the sole teacher and the sole reality. The emanation bodies of Buddhas and awakened bodhisattvas appear and disappear, whereas the wisdom light of Mother Prajnaparamita is always shining. So this is what we as women in female bodies or women in male bodies have to look to inspire us and to counteract the inadequacy that we tend as women to fall into. Now, I want to describe her a little further. This is something that I wrote a while ago where I pulled descriptions of her out of the scripture and put them together. So let me just read this to you so it gives you a sense of how she's described, because it's really quite wonderful. She's described as sanctifying and liberating, as utterly unstained. That's that sense of purity, you know, that which is pure is empty of delusion. As vast, unbounded, so there's the space aspect, radiant, pure, bright, spacious, clear, as total awareness. Now this is the natural radiance of the mind which appears in meditation practice. And when you sit down to meditate and all this crud is arising, you're not going to feel like your mind is naturally radiant. But it's the natural radiance of the mind that allows you to see that crud. So even though you may think that the radiance is obscured, it's actually there. Okay. As total awakeness, as an ever-flowing fountain of incomparable light, the source of all virtues, the ultimate teacher, the inexhaustible storehouse of truth. And then she's described as, in a more human vein, the mother who gently nurtures and carefully tends to her children. In her alone we find true refuge. So that's a pretty, actually, directly what we think of as stereotypical feminine imagery. She's an infinite eye of wisdom. She protects, lovingly protects, vulnerable conscious beings who can't protect themselves. She's the perfect wisdom who gives birthless birth to all Buddhas. In return, her children, the Buddhas, owe their existence to her, care for her, cherish and protect her, show respect to her, and pay homage to her out of their deep gratitude to her. She is their ultimate refuge and object of reverence. So the Buddhas pay homage to her. And I always, now this is really unfair to say, and I hope it's not divisive, but I always thought here was this male Buddha at the top, and us women are struggling to get there, you know. But in fact, there's a female up there. And our Buddhahood is born from her. Now, I don't mean that to to diminish maleness in any way, but you know, you guys have had your turn. Okay, now let me just see if there's anything more I want to say before I stop. Oh, yes, I do want to say one last thing, and that is that the mantra at the end of this, you know, this scripture of great wisdom. Oh, let me say two things about, because I want to I want to make the scripture slightly more comprehensible. This this sense of emptiness that Shunyata points to, the scattering of the sand, or the sense of there being no thingness, just this flow of life, that's what is being pointed to when the scripture says no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no where are we? No annihilation, no eightfold path, no suffering, no accumulation. It's not saying these things don't exist. It's saying that they're not quite like we think they are. And when we reify them into a solid object, they're not actually that. You know, you can't really take your nose off your face and have it function as a workable thing. It only works connected to your face and integrated into the whole thing. So that's the kind of what I was talking about, where the ground keeps falling away from you. There's no Buddha. There's no Prajnaparamita. And in fact, the scripture does this over and over again. You know, it'll posit something that seems perfectly reasonable to us, like a Buddha or Prajnaparamita, and then it says, that's not true. That's not actually how it is. And the ground falls away. So in the same sense that you can't posit a Buddha, you can't posit her either, you know, and you can't posit somebody at the top and somebody at the bottom trying to get to the top. You know, all of that is in some sense really fundamentally wrong. So that's what the no part in that scripture is about. And then at the end is the mantra. It says, the Prajnaparamita one should know to be the greatest mantra of them all, the highest and most peerless mantra too, a layer of all pain. And the mantra is going, going, going on beyond, and always going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. And that's the last. Hail, hail, hail. Thank you, Reverend Amanda.
Reverend Master Ji used to say that.
Don't forget the hail. See how I listen? Anyway, that mantra is, you know, that's the greatest mantra of them all. So the question that causes me to ask is, how come that one's the greatest? And I think that the answer to that, I haven't actually answered that question for myself completely, but I think that the answer in that question lies in going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. We're never there. No matter how Buddha we are, we're still going on beyond. We're never this thing. We're never this thing Buddha. We're always moving, changing, shifting. We're always in this fluid flow of emptiness, of Prajnaparamita. So we are always going on beyond. And this points us to the ongoing walking of the path that we will do no matter what form we take, human or otherwise. And we will want to remember that at the end of the day when we recite that mantra. We're going to recite it in Sanskrit, or I think Sanskrit.
Sanskrit,
yeah. I couldn't remember. The Sanskrit and the Japanese are very close together. This one's Sanskrit. So I'm going to stop talking.